Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we have Amarnath Amarasingham on the show, and we're going to talk about the current situation in Sri Lanka, as well as discuss the Easter attacks that happened a couple months ago now. I will make the disclaimer that today is June 4th, because I know we are going to post the show a little bit later, so bear in mind the date with the things we talk about. But first of all, as I like to call you Amar. Amar, thank you for coming on the Loopcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
So you just recently had a piece published in the May-June issue of the CTC Sentinel titled Terrorism on the Teardrop Island, Understanding the Easter 2019 Attacks in Sri Lanka. Fantastic piece. I highly recommend anyone to read it because it is so informative, looking at the attacks as well as the historical content, the content of the situation in the country. So amazing, amazing research on this piece. So thank you so much for writing this. And for our listeners, Amar is a senior research fellow at the London-based Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He is also the author of Pain, Pride, and Politics, Social Movement Activism, and the Sri Lankan Tamil Diaspora in Canada. He is also the co-author of Sri Lanka, the struggles for peace in the aftermath of war. And in fall, I'm very excited to announce that he'll be the assistant professor at Queen's University in Ontario. So congratulations on that new fantastic position coming up.
Thanks, Ryan.
Why don't you give our listeners a bit of an overview on the attacks that we saw in Sri Lanka this past Easter?
Yeah, so It was kind of Sunday morning. I was lying in bed fast asleep, and then a friend of mine texted me and said, you know, I think you better get up for this one. And I checked Twitter, as I tend to do, and I was kind of stunned into silence because, you know, this was these were churches that I had visited. These were cities that I have family and friends. So starting at about 8:45 in the morning, there had been a series of bombs that had gone off in five-star hotels in Colombo, the capital city, in Nugumbo, and kind of historical churches in Nugumbo, and as well as in the east of the island, in Batticlo, and a few other cities. And so these are kind of well-known churches, well-known hotels. And from the very beginning, it didn't really make any sense, right? That was the kind of my first impression of it. Kind of understanding the historical fault lines and the ethno-religious fault lines of the country, this one, the target selection mostly didn't really fit. There was no real animus towards the Christian community. We've never seen this kind of this level of an attack against places like hotels, for example, and so something was off about the attack from the very beginning, and so I started putting up on Twitter fairly early that this was very likely a kind of international plot of some kind, either with, you know, very likely linked to the Islamic State in some way or another, because it just didn't make any sense.
I mean, I remember waking up as well and turning on the TV and seeing the various locations of the attack, and just, of course, it was horrible to see this and the pain and everything. And I think the number is about over 250 individuals that were killed in that attack. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the Sri Lankan government came out initially and placed the number somewhere around 350 or 359, and then the health ministry revised the numbers a few days later to kind of bring it back down to 250, which, I mean, pissed a lot of people off, but at the same time gives you a sense of what kind of attack it was, because the health ministry put out a statement basically saying there were so many body parts that we couldn't actually identify who, you know, how many people were actually killed. And so people were a bit irritated at the government for being a little insensitive with kind of throwing out numbers without thinking about it too much. But I think it's just a testament to the kind of attack it was and how crazy of an attack it was that you know, they overestimated by 100 people the number of dead. So eventually, a few days later, it was brought back down to a little bit over 250. I forget the exact number, but yeah, around 250.
So at this point, the investigation is ongoing, and from what I've heard as in reports, it's about 56 people that are being held in custody. What do we know about the investigation, if anything?
So, I mean, the Sri Lankan government basically vacuumed up a bunch of people after the attack. As kind of many governments in South Asia do, they arrest anyone even remotely linked with any of the attackers. Drivers were picked up, cousins, you know, uncles, fathers, mothers, everyone was taken in for questioning. So the numbers of kind of the people who were arrested fluctuated quite drastically as well in terms of, you know, we've taken in 100 people, and then now we're back to, we've released a bunch, and others are being questioned by the Criminal Investigation Division and so on. But I think a few days after the attack, it was somewhere around 56 people, individuals kind of broadly linked to some of the suspects, and individuals who were kind of suspected of prior involvement in a lot of the other incidents that happened in the country, like the destruction of the Buddhist statues earlier that year in 2018, and things like that. So a lot of other bizarre events were happening towards the end of 2018 that people didn't really know what was going on, and then eventually they were able to link those kind of disparate events with some of these suspects at the Easter bombing.
So a lot of news agencies are, of course, associating this with ISIS. Let's talk about the ISIS connection and what we know about.
So, what happened very interestingly was, you know, 2 days later, ISIS put out nothing short of, I think, 3 or 4 different claims, one through their AMAC agency, one through their Nashr kind of news release, and then just before noon, on I think it was Tuesday, they released a photo with all of the attackers, and then a kind of 1 minute video, a pledge of allegiance video that came out. One thing that can be said, I think, you know, fairly clearly, is that somebody in the attack network had some kind of connection with Islamic State Central, or at least their media apparatus, right? The very fact that it was released through their official channels on Telegram at least points to some kind of network there. The broader question of whether there's any financing, logistical support, support in terms of making explosives and things like that, is still kind of up in the air, and I think will be for some time. What is interesting is that this kind of this network seems to have some sort of connection to a bunch of cells that had existed for some time in Tamil Nadu in southern India, as well as Kerala in southern India. And a lot of these guys had gone off to Syria. Some of these guys had gone off to ISIS's Khorasan province in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and I think also Kashmir. And one of these cells actually returned back to India and were arrested. And what the Indian government eventually found out was that this cell, a group of three that had gone off to fight with the Khorasan province of the Islamic State and return, were actually quite plugged in with Zakran Hashim, who is the purported mastermind of the Easter bombings, as well as some of the other attack network or individuals in the kind of Tamil Nadu cell. Whether that means that, I mean, this raises a few interesting questions in that we don't exactly know, for example, whether the Khorasan province or the leadership of the Khorasan province are actually in direct communication constantly with the leadership of ISIS Central, and what kind of relationship that is, right? And so we can tell that some people who went to go fight in parts of Afghanistan or Pakistan or Kashmir returned to India, and they were listening to the speeches of Zakran Hashim. And so that's as far as I think the evidence points to so far in terms of linkages with somebody who was fighting with ISIS at some point. There's been some other reporting more recently to say that individuals that were part of the attack network, you know, studied in Australia, studied in England. They may have communicated with Anjum Chowdhury. They may have communicated online with Neil Prakash, who's a Australian ISIS fighter who went by Abu Khalid al-Kambodi. And most people who watched ISIS since the beginning know him quite well because he was quite active online and constantly on Kick Messenger and Telegram and things like that. Whether there's some connection there is very difficult to know as well. So there's a bit of kind of pieces of speculation going on in terms of actual legit connections between the attackers and ISIS Central in any meaningful way. But I think eventually some of these pieces will be put together.
Let's discuss a little bit what they're calling the ringleader of these attacks on Easter, Zahran Hashim. And in your CTC piece, you really map out this path towards radicalization. So who is this individual and how did he get from there to here, basically?
He was a radical preacher from the East. So just to give you a little bit of background, or your listeners a bit of background on Sri Lanka, even though it's a tiny island off the coast of South India, it is kind of bizarrely complicated in its ethno-religious landscape, right? And so the east of the country, which is only about, 100 kilometers or so, actually has 30% Muslims and 30% Sinhalese, Sinhalese Buddhists, and 30% Tamils, who are predominantly Hindu. And from very early on in the 90s, there were a lot of kind of rumors going around that the Muslim community in the East was getting funding from the Saudi government, or funding was coming in from these mysterious places abroad, and had the potential to, if not radicalize, at least there was a kind of reform movement going on towards kind of more conservative forms of Islam. And it's kind of out of this climate that Zahran Hashim emerges. He finishes studies at a madrasa, and eventually comes out and forms a variety of his own organizations, which I'm not going to go into all the details because people can read about it online, but he forms one organization called Darul Athar, which stands for kind of Abode of Tradition. And from early on, it's clear that people are very uncomfortable with him, right? He speaks crazy, he's very extreme, he's always calling for violence, always raging against the Sri Lankan regime, Sri Lankan government. And from early on, they start to kind of kick him out of these organizations. So organization after organization, he joins or he starts and is eventually kicked out. And he starts really becoming kind of pro-ISIS and pro-ISIS publicly in late 2016, where in January or February, he rented out a cultural center in the East, a fairly well-known cultural center in Katankudi, called the Hezbollah Cultural Center, not to be confused with Hezbollah, the organization. he rents out this place, gives a 90-minute speech, which was kind of laced with pro-ISIS material, going on and on about how the Muslims in Sri Lanka need to contribute to the cause in Syria, and so on and so forth. And it causes a massive backlash in the community. The community doesn't want to hear it. They're freaked out by how public he's willing to talk about this stuff. And they hold a kind of counter event in February of 2017 to basically say, we're worried about this guy and we're worried about ISIS's influence in our country. And so this is how early it begins, right? September, we're talking February 2017, 2 years before any inkling of an attack. and that pushback event, the February pushback event, kind of galvanizes him even more. In March of that year, he holds a kind of rally in front of a Sufi mosque, or near a Sufi mosque, where he kind of purposely starts a fight with followers of this well-known Sufi imam or Sufi scholar in the community. And he shows up to this event basically armed with weapons, and police are called. And he goes into hiding. So a bunch of people are arrested, including several of his own family. And he and his other brother go into hiding and are basically never heard from again until the Easter bombings. And by heard from again, I mean, seen in person, kind of wandering around the community. What he was doing after he went into hiding was he put out YouTube video after YouTube video after YouTube video, which as time went on, got more and more crazy and more radical. So initially, he was just talking about launching attacks or supporting the Islamic State. But what happened in early 2018 was it became much more about killing non-Muslims in the country, taking out law enforcement, that the government of Sri Lanka is complicit in anti-Muslim violence, and that there needs to be a kind of revenge attack of some form. And this was kind of immediately after the March 2018 riots in Kandy, in the center of the country, where a week of riots happened, anti-Muslim violence, mosques were burned, businesses were burned, and Muslims were attacked on the streets and so on. And so in the same month, March 2018, he releases a video which seems to have disappeared entirely from the online space, where he goes on and on about how the government needs to pay for anti-Muslim violence. And so what happens over time, it seems, is, you know, he was conservative, he was what we might call Salafi, and he eventually became much more supportive of the Islamic State in late 2016, got immediate backlash from the community, and then kind of just spiraled into more and more kind of violence, which was precipitated also by persistent kind of anti-Muslim violence in the country as well. So sorry for the long, rambling answer.
Oh, no, it's fantastic, because there is so much background that I don't think people know about unless you really dive into this like you did in the Sentinel piece, the CTC Sentinel piece. So, I mean, it's good to hear it as well from you. So he was calling for the support of ISIS, but looking at the globe and where we've seen support for ISIS coming from, I mean, has Sri Lanka really been an area where there's been a lot of support or not? I mean, from what I gather, not a ton of individuals left Sri Lanka to join ISIS in its different provinces.
No, it was never really a major hub of any kind of ISIS activity or Al-Qaeda activity. There was kind of growing Wahhabi influence or Salafi influence in the country, but it was never kind of tipping over into jihadism in any way. Even the number that went out, that 32 Sri Lankans had gone off to Syria, is a bit misleading in a way, because it's basically only five families. So five families went kind of collectively, so their husband, wife, and their kids. And so when you add all of them up, you get 32, but it's not like 32 hardened fighters or anything like that. So even the number of people who went to Syria was fairly limited. And yeah, so we just don't have a history of jihadist plots or jihadist activity or jihadist attacks in any way. If anything, as I kind of detail in the piece, like we have almost 100 years of anti-Muslim violence with very little in terms of pushback, very little in terms of even militant resistance, or even kind of social movement organizing from the Muslim community to push back against this kind of stuff. It's mostly been kind of middle-class academics in the capital city who've pushed back against this anti-Muslim violence, or kind of campaigners internationally, academics abroad who've pushed back. But we haven't seen any real kind of mobilization of Muslims in the country to push back against persistent and kind of ongoing violence they've experienced for some time. To then suddenly see this kind of attack happen and then realize that, well, If it's going to be a consistent attack, it should have targeted Buddhist Sinhalese sites or government sites or something like that, where you can actually say that, you know, historically there's some animus there between the Muslim community and the Sinhala the hardliners, the Buddhist hardliners. And so some of those sites would have been kind of the targets that they would have chosen. Instead, what you have is a target on five-star hotels and Easter celebrations and kind of historical churches, which barely made any sense. And so I think, again, there's no real proof of this, but I think it's probably reasonable to say that the attack, you know, target selection actually came from the Islamic State, because, of course, they part of their, you know, target selection has always been Christian sites and in the Christian community around the world. And so it seems kind of like there was some mobilization from the NTJ and Zakran Hashim to eventually launch an attack locally, but it was maybe hijacked or taken over in terms of target selection by the Islamic State. When that happened, how that happened, still very much in the air.
A little bit after the attacks, we had this momentous video of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. For those that might not know, he's the emir of ISIS, the leader, we could call him that. And in this video, which was very long, him making lots of statements, he actually addressed the Sri Lanka attacks. And I know that you've spent time looking at this video. So why don't you give us an insight into what he said?
So what's interesting with the video is you have him kind of sitting, talking about the different provinces that ISIS controls at the moment. But it's quite clear that the video is recorded before the Easter attacks, or maybe not clear, but it seems like it was recorded before the Easter attacks. And then an audio message, a simple audio message by Baghdadi is appended to the video. To say, you know, thanks for the oath of allegiance and thanks for these attacks, and so on. But he actually says the attacks are in response to what happened in Baghouz al-Falkani in Syria, the last kind of village that was controlled by ISIS before it was liberated by the Syrian Democratic Forces. And so he makes no mention of, you know, local politics or local grievances or anything like that in Sri Lanka. He says it's a response to what happened in Syria. But it's kind of added on to the video towards the end to just say thanks. But you could tell, I mean, it is his voice. It's not like it's faked or anything. But it points to the fact that Baghdadi is very much alive at the time that the video was released, because it is his voice and it is... the rest of the bit is definitely him. So
going back to Hashimi, clearly he was on the radar of intelligence community of Sri Lanka, I would assume, thinking about all of the instances and the videos that he produced leading up to the attacks. And we've also heard that there were reports early in April that were provided to Sri Lankan authorities about warnings about possible attacks. Why don't we look at this and also discuss how politics are playing into all of this, because I've read a lot of interesting things about the political situation in Sri Lanka and how these reports of the attacks and warnings play into the politics of the country.
Right, yeah. So what I think happened here, it's kind of an ongoing point of debate inside the country and with politicians kind of yelling at each other and pointing fingers at each other, rightfully so. So we can kind of date whatever happened back to about October 2018 when the president, Maithripala Sirisena, got rid of his prime minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, and basically installed the former president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, as the new prime minister. And this was kind of met with all kinds of disdain because Rajapaksa was the president in power and his brother, Gotabaya, was the defense minister in power during the end of the war in Sri Lanka in 2009 against the LTTE, where a whole host of human rights violations and kind of crimes against humanity were against the LTT and Tamil civilians. And so to put this guy back in power, who's been a historical strong man for a long time, didn't make any sense. And also that Sirisena had basically uprooted Rajapaksa from the government a few years earlier. And so to kind of put him back in power didn't make any sense. But what that eventually created was that it kind of launched the country into a full-blown constitutional crisis where both prime ministers were claiming the prime ministership and neither of them kind of refused to step down, and the Supreme Court had to intervene to basically say what the president just did is not cool. We want kind of Ranil Wickremesinghe back in power. But what that did was it kind of I would say, politicized everything, right? And so even national security, which was supposed to be kind of above and beyond political bickering for the security of the country, all became highly politicized. And so different people were invited to different meetings, and some were kind of banned from attending national security meetings. And I think it's this kind of broader political climate where these warnings from the Indian government came in April, three times in April, and April 11th and onwards, or April 4th and onwards. And so it was kind of received in a climate of chaos where it didn't land on the right person's desk, let's say. I think also that whoever looked at it also suspected that this was an effort, and this is me speculating a bit, was an effort by the Indian government to kind of play a part in Sri Lankan politics as well, because there's also this bizarre push and pull relationship with India in Sri Lanka, where the Indian government likes to have a voice in who is president and who is not in Sri Lanka, and so I suspect that when they received this kind of news of a plot, they would have said, or you know, powers that be in Sri Lanka would have said, oh, this is an effort by the Indian government to make me kind of clamp down on the Muslim population in Sri Lanka and kind of create a backlash and create some more violence to kind of put certain other people in power. And so it was kind of, I think it would have been received with a bit of skepticism because it was an election season and so on. So basically those two reasons were kind of formed the backdrop in which these constant warnings are coming in from the Indian regime, Indian government about, Zafar Nasheem and the his brothers and all of these kinds of things in kind of remarkable detail as well. You don't usually see this much detail in an intelligence report where they actually give you the names of a bunch of people, attack locations and the name of the organization and all these kinds of things. But all of it was ignored or, not acted upon by the right parties. And so this is why you kind of led to the disaster of Easter. But what's happening now going into the election in later this year is both parties are basically accusing each other of being, having dropped the ball on this and so on. And then Rajapaksa is coming back into power, basically saying that I'm going to stamp out Islamic radicals and launching a whole kind of campaign against the Muslim communities. So they're not kind of, let's say, taking the right lessons from the attack in any meaningful way.
So that was going to be one of my questions, that looking at this lack of reporting or lack of really paying attention to these warnings, do we see any signs of a positive in the sense of from now on it's going to be taken more seriously? But it sounds like, unfortunately, it's once again being used for political means.
Yeah, I think it's a very frustrating country in many ways, because it's the kind of amount of misinformation, the amount of kind of everyday racism and everyday xenophobia is quite remarkable, and all kind of coming from the authoritarian community, right? So it largely originates from kind of hardline Buddhist Sinhalese groups like the Bodhabala Sena or BBS. And they kind of have this bizarre, Tamil academics used to call it the majority with a minority complex. So there's always this kind of fear that this country that belongs to the Sinhalese and belongs to the Buddhists is going to be taken over by Sharia loving Muslims and separatist Tamil parties and things like that. And there's this kind of constant fear that they're going to lose the island, which is basically what, again, has popped up post-attack with all of these kind of rumors about the Muslim community and sterilization, that the Muslims are secretly trying to sterilize the majority population to kind of eventually take over as the majority and so on. All of this kind of misinformation circulating online and circulating and kind of trickling down to the streets, but it's not being addressed or stamped out or criticized or set aside from anybody of significance in the political elite, except kind of some more liberal ministers, let's say. But it's just kind of allowed to fester and allowed to carry on as if we haven't seen it in the past, you know, directly lead to violence in any way. It's just a constant depressing place, but that's just how it's been in the world for a while.
You mentioned a little bit, but I'd love to tackle it more, the topic of social media and the online environment and how it's aided in violence throughout the history of the island and the idea of spreading misinformation. How has that played out in Sri Lanka? And currently, you mentioned it's doing the same thing again.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that the ethnic tensions, religious tensions, far predate the rise of Facebook, which in whatever 2007 or whatever it started. It's much older than social media. But what we've seen more recently is that the kind of bizarre conspiracy theories and rumors very much start online. And circulate through WhatsApp groups very quickly, circulate through Facebook groups very quickly. And kind of, you know, people like me and others who watch these rumors just dismiss them as ridiculous, and obviously this is not going to empower people, or obviously this isn't going to galvanize the community, because it's so obviously ridiculous, in that, you know, Muslim clothing store owners are spraying sterilization cream on women's panties, and so that the Sinhalese population is prevented from multiplying, stuff like that. And you're like, well, this is fucking nuts, and obviously no one's going to believe that. But you realize that it does have an impact, and it does eventually trickle into real life riots and Muslim businesses being burned and mosques being attacked and individuals being killed. And you're kind of like, who is believing this stuff, and how is it possible that and obviously insane conspiracy theories are you know, having real life impact. Part of what's happening here is that, you know, some of these get riled up, some of these conspiracy theories rile people up, but then we've started to see real evidence of kind of some political influence, some law enforcement influence, some military influence on some of these protests and some of these riots. You know, they're not stamped down quickly enough. They're allowed to fester. They're kind of actively supported sometimes. And social media has played a role in that as well, where particularly this time around, the riots that followed the Easter attacks, you saw, for example, addresses of Muslim-owned businesses being posted online. You had photos of kind of the store Muslim stores being posted online, mosque addresses being posted online, and then eventually people kind of, you know, attacking those sites. And so you've seen... we've kind of seen how these things play out so often. And I think Facebook and WhatsApp are trying their very best to kind of keep up with this. But, of course, they're limited by language and they're limited by cultural nuance and understanding what's really happening on the ground. And certain kind of derogatory words that show up in the Sinhala language that may not be completely obvious to an outsider. And things like that. And so they're trying their best, but I think they're you know, going to be overwhelmed a little bit. The other challenge is the WhatsApp groups, and I don't know how much these companies have eyes on these kind of massive WhatsApp groups that exist at in some cases, where I'm part of a few now which have, you know, 3,000, 4,000 people in them, and things get spread very quickly, and then this similar kinds of memes and similar kinds of messages end up on Facebook and so on. And a lot of these guys have learned to be very smart about it, right? So instead of having a text, for example, where the kind of, you know, some kind of software might be able to catch it, it's embedded right into the image, and so all you see is a kind of image being posted in terms of its metadata, whereas a lot of the machine learning may not be able to capture the actual text on the word, particularly when we're talking about foreign languages and things like that. So, I think these social media companies have their work cut out for them, particularly in places like Sri Lanka, Myanmar, where we've seen where we've seen real violence, kind of on the heels of some kind of bizarre online campaign.
So as you've mentioned, there have been a number of anti-Muslim attacks and protests since the Easter bombings. In your opinion, considering the ethno-relations going on in the country and ethno-religious relations, in the wake of this violence, what does the future hold as far as challenges and hopefully some positives maybe for Sri Lanka, if there are any?
I think I'm the wrong person for optimism, but I think there is some opportunity for kind of setting a new course if the government and if the majority population recognizes that, you know, within the majority strain, there is kind of, you know, extremist elements, right? And which has rarely been talked about. I mean, it's been talked about, which has rarely been addressed, to say that within the majority population, there are these crazy ethno-supremacists and Buddhist religious supremacists who never really see a place for minorities in the country, who don't know what to do with the Tamil community, don't know what to do with the Muslims in the country, who don't fit within this kind of ethno-religious paradigm that they've built for themselves. And unless that's addressed from the top down, from families, family members, governments, community leaders, nothing's really going to change. And we've seen just as I'm talking to you, there's a crazy case going on in Kurunegala, which is just outside of the capital, where a doctor was arrested. And then Buddhist monks started visiting the police station to basically say, this guy is responsible for forcibly sterilizing 4,000 women. And then the police are kind of forced to take it seriously, and they put out a call basically saying, if there's any complaints about this doctor, please come forward. And all these women started to come forward to say, you know, we were forcibly sterilized by this doctor because I had a kid and now I've been able to have a second kid, so clearly he must be responsible. And it's kind of spiraling into these kind of sterilization rumors again, which in the past have led to actual violence. We haven't seen any actual violence this time around, but I think it's really only a matter of time before these kinds of cases, this constant fear of the majority population being secretly hampered in some way by insidious minorities, continues to cause violence on the streets. And I think it's just, I don't see any major pushback from those in power to say, how are we going to address these conspiracies? How are we going to address this bizarre sense of insecurity in the majority population? And I think until that's addressed, we're not going to see much change. And this existed, you know, pre-social media. It's been sped up and expanded through social media. And I think we'll probably see future instances of it.
Going back to the attacks, what sort of questions are we left with? Because it seems like there are a lot of things that haven't been answered, and I'm sure, hopefully, as the investigation goes forward, we'll get some more answers. But what sort of questions are we left with, whether they're specific to the attacks or larger?
I think one of the questions I have is what happened to Zakran Hashim around the 2015-16 mark, because it seems like he went from basically just being a pain-in-the-ass conservative Muslim preacher to quite openly being an advocate for the Islamic State. So I'd like to get a bit more details on what happened there, who he talked to, what inspired him. It might have been simply that he was watching ICE videos or something, or it might have been someone locally, or whether he was communicating with someone. I don't think we have any real sense of that. And I'd also like to get a bit more sense of how the attack network was in communication with anybody in ISIS Central, whether it's in Syria, Iraq, or the Khorasan province. There's no real sense of that yet. And I'd like to get a sense of what actually went wrong with all of this information that was coming from the Indian regime. There's been some accusations about right people didn't pay attention to it and so on, but a little bit more detail in terms of what actually happened and how the internal disagreements between the prime minister and the president may have interfered with that would be some of the questions I have going forward in terms of the details of the attack. The broader question, of course, is what is the Islamic State planning with the South Asian, in the South Asian landscape, particularly now that they've declared an Indian province and declared a Pakistan province? Are we going to actually see more logistical support given to these provinces, more finances sent to these provinces? Are more fighters going to be moving into these provinces? What does it actually mean to, you know, allow this or declare a province in South Asia? We kind of know what it meant in Syria in terms of kind of religious institutions that were built, and the structures that were put into place, the state structures that were put into place. But it's a little different when you declare something. You know, will it Hind or Pakistan? So I'd like to get a sense of, or at least watch very closely going forward, how the Islamic State, you know, reacts to South Asia and what kind of plans it has for South Asia, and whether we can notice any actual legit kind of materials being sent that way as opposed to just kind of inspiration.
Also, in your opinion, so we had this Khorasan province, and now, as you said, we've had these new provinces of India and Pakistan, and Khorasan is kind of an umbrella province, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and somewhere in between. Why do you think we're seeing these two provinces of Pakistan now and India being separated and honed out as specific provinces versus falling potentially under the umbrella of the Khorasan?
I think two reasons. One, there's a kind of propaganda element to it. So this is why there might be a sense that there'll be increased attacks in these regions, because the kind of propaganda landscape is being prepared to take full advantage of any attacks that happen locally. The other reason, as kind of Hassan explained somewhere, I think on Twitter, was that, you know, as these provinces become smaller or fractured, they can kind of take care of their own internal dealings a bit more. They can fight back against infiltration, factionalism, egos, and things like that. And so, as opposed to having this massive province, which you're responsible for kind of coordinating attacks in Pakistan and Kashmir and India, in Sri Lanka, it might make more sense to kind of stand up these kind of smaller regions as responsible for their own activities in those regions. So this is the opposite of what was happening in Syria and Iraq in July 2018, where ISIS basically consolidated 20 plus of its provinces into two. And part of the reason for doing that, I think, is also to a level of propaganda value to say now they can claim a whole bunch of attacks in Syria under this one banner, as opposed to trying to explain why, you know, Kirkuk only had one attack or something like that. They can say Iraq has a bunch of attacks, and that they're still kind of active and very much have an eye towards Syria and Iraq and maintaining the presence there. But I think kind of diversifying, if you will, in Africa and South Asia sets the stage for kind of increased activity in these regions as well. And so whether that actually happens, we'll have to kind of keep a close eye on. But it seems like that's part of what the goal is, to eventually have much more activity in the regions where you've diversified and stood up provinces on their own.
Well, to wrap up the talk, we like to give our guests, if time permits, the opportunity to maybe touch something that we might not have touched on or have a final thought. So I want to hand the floor over to you.
Sure, yeah. I think what kind of the Sri Lanka attacks brought home for me, because it was kind of this bizarre moment where everything I've studied in South Asia and everything I've been studying on the ISIS landscape kind of converged into one thing and kind of stunned me into silence for a couple of days. But I think what's become kind of obvious, and it's something we know already in the academic space, is that you know, there's very much a localized component to a lot of these conflicts. So when we talk about Kashmir, when we talk about India and Pakistan, I mean, I think sometimes terrorism scholars lose sight of the local, lose sight of the historical kind of aspects of these countries. And it's something I think we should, you know, keep in mind much more often, because part of what the Sri Lanka attacks had me doing was, you know, explaining to Sri Lanka scholars what ISIS was, and then explaining to ISIS scholars what was happening in Sri Lanka, and kind of realizing that we're missing enormous, you know, both sides were missing enormous chunks of what was important to kind of explaining the attack. And if that's happening in Sri Lanka, it's very much happening in a lot of other countries that these attacks happen in. So it's just something to keep in mind in terms of the importance of kind of understanding, of course, understanding transnational terrorist groups and their objectives, but also understanding the local context a bit more thoroughly and how those two interact, I think will be important going forward.
Thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast. This has been really fantastic and insightful and eye-opening in so many ways.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me. It was great.
And for our listeners that want to know more about Sri Lanka, I highly recommend Amar's books and also the CTC piece that we've mentioned a number of times. Really goes into so much detail about the attacks during this Easter as well as the run-up to them. So do read those if you're interested. Thank you so much.